We take space flight for granted now. We've gotten used to the idea of people spending months on the International Space Station, for example, with their hair and clothing floating around them. But just 60 years ago, people had never flown into space. Flights for people didn't happen until 1961. And before we sent people up, we sent up animals, including a dog named Laika, who flew into space aboard the Soviet ship Sputnik 2 in 1957. Ship is kind of an overstatement. It's more like the size of a medicine ball. Scientists did not know just how to bring a spacecraft back from orbit at the time. So Laika, the first creature to orbit the Earth, died in space. It's easy to get choked up about the poor dog. But Kurt Caswell gives us a lot of detail on the story of Laika and her mission in the book Laika's Window, The Legacy of a Soviet Space Dog. Kurt Caswell is a writer and professor of creative writing and literature at Texas Tech University. His work includes field courses on writing and leadership, the field being the mountains and rivers of the West. Kurt Caswell, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So this book is not exactly in the outdoorsy mold we were just talking about. What got you thinking about space and this dog?
Well, you know, the book isn't and space isn't so much, but dogs certainly are. And I've been a longtime dog lover and I guess dog companion, dog owner. And a friend of mine, editor, said to me, you might think about writing about this dog. She has a very compelling story.
She does indeed, and I remember first reading about Laika when I was in elementary school. Like, oh, what a cute dog. What happened to her? What? She died in space. Have we learned new things about Laika's mission since those days?
Yes. We've learned quite a bit about how she died in the days after her launch. The Soviet Union was really reporting that Laika was alive in space, but it wasn't until about 2002... in a lecture given in Houston at the space conference that a Russian scientist announced to the world that Laika had died only a couple of hours into her flight, primarily due to heat exhaustion.
Oh, it got hot up there?
Right. So the satellite had taken a highly elliptical orbit, which is they hadn't planned for, and most of the time it spent in the sun. So they were depending on part of the cooling of the spacecraft, the satellite, to happen when it was on the shaded side of the Earth. But it spent a great deal more time in the sunny side, on the sunny side.
Oh.
And so it just couldn't cool down. So the capsule heated up, and Laika was unable to manage those temperatures, and so was the cooling system on the spacecraft. It wasn't able to manage that heat.
Okay, so at least we know a little more about the specifics now. But, you know, I mean,
yeah.
It's interesting over time, though, and it, you know, it starts with my own experience in elementary school. We seem to care more about the fate of the puppy than a lot of astronauts.
Yeah, that's true. I think, you know, there's something about dogs, human beings and dogs. We've been in relationship for a very long time, 15,000 years, some people say even longer, maybe 50 to 100,000 years, and we've really evolved with dogs. So in many ways, dogs are inseparable from us, and we from them.
So why is the book, Kurt, called Laika's Window?
So the Soviet scientists and engineers, they included a window in her capsule. And in looking into her story, I was really interested in whether or not, first of all, why was the window there? And then secondly, could Laika see out of that window when she was in orbit around the Earth, even if for a short time? And so the investigation there became a central metaphor for the book, really, of that window that Laika might have seen the cosmos from space and seen the Earth. And then her human handlers, the medical staff and the scientists and engineers, they were able to monitor when she was on the ground through that window. So I saw that window as this exchange of information, right, between the dog and between human beings.
Hmm.
I found that very poetic and beautiful.
You begin essentially at the end of the story, what amounted to Laika's burial in space in April 1958, when the orbit of Sputnik 2 decayed enough to bring it down. Was that always what was figured to happen?
Yes, Yes, the satellite was not going to stay up for very long because of its just partly the ability for the Soviet team to get that satellite far enough away from the Earth, right, to orbit in a higher orbit, so that it would stay in orbit longer. So it was going to have a short life, and Sputnik 1 also came down in a similar period of time. But they orbited together, Sputnik 1 and Sputnik 2, for some time as well.
So how big a leap was this? I mean, we're talking 1958, they're both still up there. How big a leap for human adventure, both the launch and what we got from them?
Well, it was a fantastic leap. The United States, we were also trying to put up a satellite at the same time, and the teams that were working on that over here had no idea that the Soviet Union was so far ahead of them. Not that far, really, a matter of months and years, perhaps, but it was a real shock when that satellite went up, and as you know, totally changed the way that we live on Earth now that we have satellites in space.
I think it was my parents who had stashed away a couple of old newspaper headlines from that time, but I remember seeing the headlines about, you know, Soviets send up moon, because that's what we called them then. It was like this was a new moon for the Earth.
Right. The moon itself is a satellite, so that term is really defining anything that orbits another body. And interestingly, some writers have said that all spacecraft are really like little planets, because they include living organisms, not just astronauts and cosmonauts, but animals in the past, and then, you know, all the research organisms, and then communities of bacteria that live inside of the space station, for example.
Sure, all kinds of stuff up there, but we're focusing on Laika the dog, Laika's Window, the Legacy of a Soviet Space Dog, the book by Kurt Caswell. We'll come back and talk more with Kurt and talk to you as well when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Kurt Caswell, who teaches creative writing and literature at Texas Tech and is the author of several books. His latest is about a dog in space. The first creature to orbit the Earth was a dog sent up by the Soviet Union on Sputnik 2 named Laika, who didn't live for very long, and we just found out she died of heat exhaustion because her capsule spent too much time in the sun. Her fame is so much greater in death, apparently, than it would have been in life. But we're talking about Laika's Window and all it talks about for us as a species and what we do with our creatures as well. You can join the conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So Kurt, I mean, what did we really know at that point as the Soviets were preparing to send Laika into space about what might happen to creatures in the orbit of the planet Earth?
Right, we didn't really know much at all. Really, the three areas that most of those animal flights were looking into were radiation exposure. So could a human being manage the radiation exposure in orbit? Microgravity, we had no idea what would happen to the human body or to the body of a dog in microgravity. We didn't know if, say, the heart would just stop beating. So that was important to know. And then the other question that was primary is, could a living organism survive a flight in a rocket? So the dogs were trained to manage those three conditions on the ground before they were sent into space.
All right, let's take this back in time a bit, because you go there in the book and talk about early balloonists and animals. How long ago did we start sending things aloft, and how'd that go?
In the 1700s, balloons were taking animals up into as high as they could, as high as they could get them. And the plan there again was human flight. That was always the mission around animals. It was, how can we get human beings into the sky and then into space? So about the 1700s is a good date.
So, and how many years were they sending things up before a person would risk going up in a balloon?
A couple of hundred, right? So, meaning from the balloons onward, but After Laika's flight into orbit, Yuri Gagarin.
Let me go back to balloons. I would just mean once we were testing with the sheep and chickens and all the other things that the Montgolfier brothers were using. How long before a person actually agreed to go up in a balloon?
Well, the Montgolfier brothers actually flew in their own balloons. They didn't fly very high, but they were testing after those sheep and chickens. They were testing those balloons and mostly on a tether. So they would just go up, ascend in the balloon, but it was attached to the ground on a tether, so they weren't to launch off into a unknown land and crash.
Okay, so people did take a risk on that, but then when it was space flight, that's something a little different. And Laika, not the only animal sent up in those early days, a lot of suborbital flights before Laika. What did we send up aboard them?
The Soviets were sending up dogs suborbitally, and then in the U.S., primarily monkeys, and then a little bit later, two chimpanzees, which became quite famous, particularly Ham. Ham went up into just to the edge of space and came back, and he was the test pilot, basically, for Alan Shepard, who became the first American in space. But in addition, there were, at later times, there were just a menagerie of organisms going into space, fruit flies, various kinds of fish, lots of microorganisms and pieces of, let's say, biological material like skin and cancer cells. And so you name it, it's probably been into space.
Huh. And so what kinds of results did we get both here and in the Soviet Union with animals that were sent up to bring back?
Well, the all of those flights were, say, incrementally, we would get a little bit more information and finally come to a place where we thought, okay, it's safe. We can send a human being up and bring them back safely, although the long-term effects of, say, especially radiation and microgravity were still unknown. And those effects really are pretty hard on astronauts when they're in, say, the space station for prolonged periods of time, and they're absorbing a lot more radiation than they would on Earth, as well as the, say, wear and tear on their bones and muscles from that microgravity environment. So it's a long period of just learning a little bit at a time, and the research is ongoing, eventually for possibly a long-term deep space mission, right, crewed mission to Mars.
I guess the question I haven't asked is, I mean, we knew that Laika was going up to die because we didn't know how to bring her back at the time, but even on the suborbital flights where retrieval is expected, what were the effects of some of the animals? Like, we lost a few, didn't we?
Yes. So about among those flights that the Soviet Union sent up, I think the recovery rate was about 60%. So the dogs would often come back alive. They would go up to the edge of space and come back on a parachute. Or after Laika, we learned to deorbit the spacecraft and bring those down on a parachute. And so some of those dogs were... There were problems with the flight, meaning the rocket might have blown up on the pad, or it went off course and crashed in the desert or in the sea, and some of those dogs were lost. But quite a few of them came back alive, and many of them were then retired and lived out their lives in the homes of some of the scientists and engineers who worked on the project. Mm-hmm. So one of the primary features of looking into the story was the empathy that the Soviet team had for the dogs they worked with, that they loved these dogs and trained them and cared for them even after they flew.
Oh, okay, so they had homes once they got back to Earth, which again, most of them did.
Right.
And it wasn't just dogs that you remark in the book that even a cat went up in space at one point?
Right. France sent up a cat, and her name was Felicette. She remains, as far as I know, the only cat ever to fly into space, and she came back and survived her mission.
So has every animal that has gone into space, with the exception, I guess, of the fruit flies, have they gone into centrifuges first for training, testing?
That's a good question. I don't think all of them, but the dogs did for sure. And the chimpanzees, Ham and Enos, they also were training on those centrifuges. But I think some of those flights were just a little bit less. They weren't so concerned about the preparation, say, with some of the smaller early monkey flights.
All right, so yeah, there were a couple of casualties there too. You mentioned Ham and Enos, who the difference with them was they were sent up in the actual Mercury capsules that were the first manned vehicles for the United States space program. So we'd already established by this point that people would survive getting into space. What additional were we trying to prove with the two chimps?
So with both Ham and Enos, they were prepping for the first American into space, and then the first American to orbit, who was John Glenn. But one of the questions that team was trying to answer is, could a human being work in space? So once you got up there, sure, you can survive, but can you function? Could you pilot a spacecraft? Can you perform science experiments? Can you repair the spacecraft? So Ham and Enos were trained to pull a series of levers and push buttons in a certain order. And then once they learned that sequence while they were in space, they would perform it. And if they made a mistake, they received an electric shock through the bottom of their feet that would tell them, you've made an error, and they would try to correct it.
Yikes. So it wasn't a pleasure cruise, that's for sure.
Correct.
Although Enos, you point out, tried to make this a bit of a pleasure cruise. They took some special precautions with Enos. Could you explain those?
Yes. Are you talking about the catheter?
Yes.
Right. So Enos was wearing a catheter in space, and that was apparently because he liked to touch himself often. And so the team didn't like that. They didn't want that to happen while he was in space. But there was a malfunction with the electrical system with Enos, and he was getting shocks, although he was performing his tasks properly. So he kept getting shocked, and he eventually ripped that catheter out, which must have been extremely painful.
All for the sake of him not playing with himself in space. Why did NASA care?
I don't know. That's a funny question. It's a good question, and a funny response on NASA's part, I think, to worry too much about that. But maybe they thought it would distract him, or it was just unsightly.
But Enos did make it back to Earth okay?
He did. Yep, he made it back to Earth, and he didn't live very long after that. But Ham did. Ham lived out a long life and actually gained quite a bit of weight. He became about twice the size that he was when he flew.
Huh, strutting his stuff, maybe because he'd been the first chimp in space.
right.
Kurt Caswell's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about animals in space, but primarily through the story of one animal, and that is Laika, the Soviet dog sent up aboard Sputnik 2 in 1957, who died soon after launch, but was the first creature to orbit the Earth, and then came down when Sputnik's orbit decayed and burned up in the atmosphere. The book that Kurt Caswell wrote is called Laika's Window, The Legacy of a Soviet Space Dog. You're welcome to join the conversation on the exchange. Maybe you have some memories from that time you want to share. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So it wasn't that long after Sputnik 2 that the Soviets and the Americans later figured out how to bring people back from orbital flight alive. We didn't know that when Sputnik 2 went up, though. What was the rush? Why was Laika sent up to certain death?
Well, it was a competition, between the Soviet Union and the United States. And there was actually global science project going on called the International Geophysical Year, in which scientists from all over the world were making all kinds of observations, some of them about the Earth from space, and the goal of a number of teams was to get a satellite up, to get the first satellite up to orbit the Earth. So the Soviet Union and the United States were really in competition, and after Sputnik 1 went up, Khrushchev said to his chief designer, Sergei Korolev, hey, can we do this again. You know, that really freaked the Americans out. We have shown the world that we are technologically superior. Let's do it again and make it something special. And because the Soviet Union had been sending dogs to the edge of space for about a decade, it just seemed like a natural move to try a biological satellite, and a dog would have been the obvious choice because those dogs were already trained and they had the hardware too to house them.
Do we know why the Soviets chose dogs instead of primates, as the American testers apparently went with?
Yeah, because the dog is really a hardier animal than the small monkeys that we were working with in the United States. And the Soviet Union, the Russians knew that they knew dogs. They knew how to work with dogs. There was a history of training and working with dogs in research, as in Pavlov's dogs, for example. And, you know, Russian people love dogs. So the dog seemed a natural choice for them. And many of the space dogs, they had to be a certain size. Most of them were female, and they even wanted them to be of a lighter color so they could show up on camera. Many of them were collected as strays off the streets, in especially Moscow.
And is that where Laika came from?
Yeah, the story is that she came off the street in Moscow as well.
So we don't really know much of anything about her her lineage or anything like that. There's certainly no pedigree with Laika.
Yep.
So there is a Laika breed, but she was not a purebred. So why did she have that name?
So the name Laika, the word itself means something like little barker, or the dog that barks. She had several names before that that are referenced here and there, but Laika is the name that that stuck with her because apparently she was fond of barking. And you know, in the book, I wonder a bit about that term, if it's a term of endearment. You know, if they used it as a kind of definition of her, or it was more of an annoyance. They called her Barker because she barked too much and bothered people.
Well, you know, she got some other names, it appears, from her journey. Was it the American media who were labeling her Mutnik?
Correct, yeah, yeah, which is a play on Sputnik, obviously.
Sure. So all right, it's a little barker, but it sounds like that even if she did bark, and we haven't quite established that yet, that she had some good traits, some things that made her a great candidate for going up into space. What were those traits?
Right. The teams that were training the dogs, the dogs would they would cycle out when they couldn't manage the training. So if the dog in their training, say, managed the centrifuge well, could manage confinement in a small space for long periods of time, even up to 20 days, meaning the capsule, and also that they had a very calm and sort of easy personality. Those were some of the key traits that they were looking for. And some of those dogs just, they couldn't handle the training and they were retired immediately. But Laika was a hardy dog. You know, she came off the streets of the city where she had to piece a living together and endure cold winters. And so those qualities really made her this famous space dog, but they also, in many ways, condemned her, right, to an end in space.
So she got promoted, and then, what she earned for a promotion was death in space.
Right.
It sounds like it was pretty close, though, Kurt, to which dog would go up first.
Right. You mean the selection of which dog would go?
Yes.
Yes, that there was another dog that the team felt that would have been a better choice. Her name is Albina, but she was, in short, better liked by the team. So Laika was a little less known. She hadn't proved herself in space, and Albina had already flown and come back alive, and then she had a litter of puppies. And the team making the selection just couldn't bear to see Albina go into space and risk herself again, and also risk with that litter of puppies that they would lose their mother. So they chose Laika over her.
Okay. So interesting. So we like you better. You get to stay on Earth. Laika, you
exactly.
Get to go up. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Laika apparently had a few surgeries to prepare her for flight, which I hadn't heard about before. What did they do to her?
Yes, so she had a couple of electrode rings implanted in her chest that were attached to wires, and then those wires were drawn up under her skin and out her back so that she would be... So they were looking to monitor heart rate and respiration and movement in the capsule when she was in space. For respiration, she just had a kind of close-fitting suit, right, that she would inhale and exhale, and it would expand and contract. And then she had her carotid artery removed from her neck and folded into a little flap of skin so that it was on the outside in order for them to get a cuff on there so they could take her pulse.
Because otherwise it's really hard to take the pulse and blood pressure when the carotid artery is that deep in the neck muscles of a dog. Wow,
right.
More we'll find out about Laika and her trip into space and into history. The book is called Laika's Window, The Legacy of a Soviet Space Dog. Kurt Caswell is the author and our guest. We'll come back and talk more with him. And if you'd like to join us, we'll talk to you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Kurt Caswell from Texas Tech University, a professor of creative writing and literature. Several books to his credit. His latest is called Laika's Window, The Legacy of a Soviet Space Dog. Laika was the dog who went up into space into an orbital flight. She was the first creature to orbit the Earth aboard Sputnik 2 in 1957. Its orbit decayed, and what was left of Sputnik 2 came back to Earth in 1958. It's a story that, you know, it's sad that Laika died, but she certainly is immortal in a sense for having gone through this. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about Laika and her legacy. 800-838-3760 for your comments, questions, and perhaps memories to share. You can send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Kurt, what was the arrangement aboard Sputnik 2? We talked about the size of it early on, but this sounds like basically the size of carry-on luggage.
How the satellite was constructed?
Yeah, the room that she had in there.
Yeah, so it was a bit of a pyramid shape, and there was a cylinder on top of the satellite that was housing some of the scientific instruments, especially the instruments that they're using to measure radiation. And then below that, there was a sphere, which was actually a second Sputnik 1. So they built two spheres for Sputnik 1 in case the first failed. Repurposed the second one to house batteries and some of the electrical equipment. And then below that was Laika in her capsule. And she was in a small cylinder with these sort of rounded caps on either end. And inside that was a sealed cylinder. So she wasn't wearing a spacesuit with a helmet. She was just sitting inside the cylinder.
And but tight quarters. She could stand up and sit down, but she couldn't turn around. Is that right?
Correct. And they could measure a little bit of her movement. So she was seated in that capsule and facing that small window and able to look out.
So you mentioned that the tests for the dogs involved something like 20 days confinement. Did she show any signs of restlessness over that time?
Yeah, I'm sure she did. There's not really a record that I found of specific tests and how she responded, but some of what I read was after, you know, a couple of days, the dogs would become very agitated and start to bark and essentially be kind of asking to be released. But when they weren't released, they would calm down after a period of time, and then they could go for a much longer period.
So we've established the fact already that science hadn't advanced to the point of being able to send an object into orbit and bring it back without burning it up. So they had planned for Sputnik 2 for Laika to be alive for 7 days. Was that just all the air supply she had? And how are they dealing with food and water and waste?
That's a good question. So I was going to add to that, too, the common understanding that Laika died of heat exhaustion, which is true. But in the capsule, they gave her a feeding, one big lump of food, and they had created this kind of mixture of powdered meat and bread with water, and the agar, which is a jelly-like substance, to make sure that it would stick to a feeding tray and it wouldn't float around inside the capsule. So when I started doing the math on this, looking at the recipe for that space dog food and then how much water a dog might need of her size, it became very obvious to me that Laika just didn't have enough water when she was in the capsule. And she sat on the top of that rocket. The rocket was on the ground with Laika sealed inside the capsule for 3 days before they launched. So just doing the math, it became clear to me, and I think this is new information, I haven't read this anywhere, that that Laika was really severely dehydrated there before she even launched. And so even if the capsule had not heated up, it's quite likely that she would have not lived very much longer once she got into orbit.
Okay, so this is the point where animal lovers get their hackles up. And in fact, the first story I read about Laika many years ago said that her food was poisoned. You didn't find that to be true, evidently.
Correct. There was a bit of information about the team working on some kind of a means of killing Laika from the ground. So Laika gets into orbit, and the team decides that she seems to be suffering, and they need to put her down. But none of those methods seem to materialize. And after the Soviet Union stopped reporting on Laika and said that she had died in space, which was about day 10 after the launch, not 3 hours. She died in about 3 to 5 hours, but they didn't announce her death for another 9 days. So there were rumors, really, about how she died, and some of those rumors were her food was poisoned, she was given an injection, the oxygen ran out, and those were just, those were people talking around the event.
All right, so the officially stated cause is heat exhaustion. You suspect dehydration combined with that. Basically, it was like putting a dog that hadn't had a drink of water in a while in the back seat of a car with the windows closed.
Correct. Yep. And there was a moment in just before the launch that the medical team got together and they convinced the chief designer that they needed to open the capsule to equalize the air pressure. But in fact, what they wanted to do was give Laika water. And they were allowed to do that just before the launch. They took a syringe and they squirted some water into that feeding tray because she had already eaten all of that food that they'd given her. And that was just the last little bit of water she had before she went into space.
Oh, and when she was going to do some number one and number two up there, what were they doing to deal with that?
Well, they had a waste catchment system that was part of the flight suit and, essentially like a bag hanging off the back of a horse or something. And for the construction of this system, they primarily wanted to have female dogs because there was not a option, in that tiny little space for, say, a male dog to stand up and lift its leg.
Uh-huh.
So for that reason, most of the space dogs were female.
Ah, okay. That makes a lot of sense. Let's move on to happier things here. You write that one of the most important stories of the Soviet dog flights is what Vladimir Yazdovsky did with Laika before she was flown to the launch site. What was that?
Right. So he was a chief medical officer and part of the team that trained the dogs and selected them for their various flights. And the story is that Yazdovsky, just before they flew Laika to Kazakhstan to the launch site, that he took her home for an evening to let her play with his children. And, the famous line that he spoke or wrote in his memoir was that he wanted to do something nice for her because she didn't have long to live.
That's a weird feeling, I can imagine.
Yeah, a little bit happier, as you say, but not a lot happier.
Yeah, and so what do you see as the importance of that story to the overall tale of Laika?
Well, doing the research, I really, as a dog lover myself, I really felt that I would be sort of outraged by what happened to her and saddened by it, and that in some ways that's true, but at the same time, I started to see her. I was unable to see her anymore as a lab animal and a victim. And I started to regard her as more of a working dog, like a search and rescue dog or a service dog of some kind, because she was very well cared for. She probably had a much better life in the kennels there, in the training center, than she would have had on us on the streets in Moscow. And she was highly trained to do a job. And when that task came before her, she did it. So I started to feel much better about her as a dog, as a working dog instead of a victim.
Kurt, did Leica's treatment ultimately lead to changes in how animals are used in science experiments?
You know, her flight came before the ethical code of how animals are to be treated. I don't know if her flight directly led to changes, but what became clear to me is that a lot of scientists working with animals really do already, because they're human beings and they're empathetic. They do care for the animals that they're working with, and they do, in general, wish to inflict very little harm and not to use animals at all, if possible.
How I'm curious about some of the other dogs here. How long did Albina, who did not go into orbit, live? Do you have a story on her?
I don't have a story on her. I don't know how long she lived.
But this is the interesting thing, is that you know, Leica's life was relatively short, we believe, and yet she's a bigger star in death than she probably would have been in life. I mean, we were just learning the names of Albina and the others from this book.
True. And there's a number of dogs that flew, say, once or twice that are, you know, just essentially ignored by history. And those dogs lived quite long lives after they were retired and then went, you know, to live with one of the people who worked with them. So it is interesting that it's Leica's death that brings us so close to her in the way that we feel for what she had to endure.
You were able to talk to at least one of the people involved with the Soviet program, weren't you?
Well, most of those people are gone that were directly involved. I did have an opportunity to talk with Sergei Khrushchev, who is the son of the former Premier Khrushchev, Premier at the time. And he's in his 80s now, and he spoke with me. And he knew Sergei Korolev, who was the chief designer. And so that was a really interesting conversation. When I told him about Leica going home with Yazdovsky, he said to me that he didn't think it was possible. He'd never heard that story before. And then he said, you know, laughing, he said, but it's, of course, Russia, where anything is possible.
How did he feel about his father being kind of the villain in the sense of pushing to get an orbital flight with something living aboard before we're even ready to bring it back safely?
Well, actually, what he says is that his father really deferred always to the engineers, to the scientists, and it really wasn't Khrushchev pushing. It was Korolev. This is his read on it, that Korolev might have presented it as, this is the mandate from above. We have this 1 month. We have to get this satellite up. But according to Sergei Khrushchev, his father would have been much more accepting of Korolev's readiness to launch.
Okay, you are far from the only person writing about Leica. In fact, you mentioned another one here, Nick Abazis's graphic novel. What did he deal with?
Right. So he tells Leica's story. It's a really beautiful book, and it's fiction, but it's based obviously in. The real events of Leica's life, and some of it is imagined, especially, say, Leica's life before she was brought into the kennels there. But really wonderful treatment of, say, the relationship between Leica and her handlers.
Okay, so a chance to look at the human side of the people who dealt with Leica before she before they put her in a capsule and shot her into space.
Right.
Leica's appearance, her likeness has appeared on lots of stuff. I mean, how big a dog star is she still?
Well, you know, it's interesting when I started to look into like a story, very few people in the United States that I talked to knew anything about her or had even heard of her. But a lot of people in European countries that I talked to knew her story right away or part of her story. But during, just after her flight, her image was everywhere, all over the world. It was on postage stamps and on chocolate wrappers and boxes and matchbook covers. There was a Leica brand of cigarettes. And then as I was working on her story, I started to collect uses of her name, more contemporary uses of her name. So I found several musical bands that are named after Leica, one in Boise, Idaho called Leica the Dog. There's a hot dog stand or restaurant in Detroit called Leica Dog. And then you probably know Leica Studio in Hillsboro there, up near Portland.
Yeah, right. The maker of the stop motion movies, which used to be Will Vinton Studios. So, yeah. Wow. So, yeah, all kinds of Leica references. And I did confirm that is named after her as well. So, wow, quite a legacy she left. And we're still talking about her more than 60 years later. The book is called Leica's Window, The Legacy of a Soviet Space Dog. It's the work of Kurt Caswell, who's been our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Kurt, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.